Remote learning nationwide has led to students falling behind, especially the most vulnerable. How we help students catch back up. That's where we begin today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 8th. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's great to have you with us. We'll hear from some of you about how your children are faring with remote learning.
Both of my 15-year-old twin, Jack and Athena, Jack has benefited from being on the remote educational platform, but Athena, being out of the classroom, her grades have gone from A's and B's to C's, D's, and F's.
Also on the show, with multiple crises in Puerto Rico, the Fiscal Oversight Board is now looking to privatize utilities on the island. And to round out the show, we're talking TV reboots. What would you want to see rebooted, and what would you change?
The Brady Bunch with a blended, multiracial, intergenerational family.
I dream of Jeannie, because man, don't we all need Jeannie right now.
After a few weeks of remote learning because of rising COVID-19 cases, New York City elementary schools are back open for in-person learning for tens of thousands of students. The push to keep the nation's largest school district open for in-person learning during the pandemic has been divisive, but it's been driven in part by the fear that many students will fall behind. And now new data backs some of those fears up and indicates that many of the country's most vulnerable students are experiencing the most severe setbacks. A new study released by the consulting firm McKinsey & Company showed that remote learning caused white students to fall behind 1 to 3 months in math, while students of color were set back 3 to 5 months in the same subject. And those numbers are expected to keep getting worse the longer the pandemic persists. Another alarming metric, falling grades among Black and Latino students learning English, and students with disabilities. According to the Washington Post, school districts from Maryland to California are reporting a sharp rise in low grades for students from these groups. And we asked you if you felt your children were falling behind this year, and here's what one of you had to tell us.
My name is Evan from Rockton, Illinois. My 6-year-old daughter is struggling reading and math. She is below where she needs to be, and I believe she may need to repeat first grade if she doesn't get some extreme intervention this summer. I plan to get her in with a tutor service to help catch up, but even with that, I know there are emotional and social struggles she has as well. She has no friends to hang out with her age, and most of her time has been spent with her parents, grandparents, and little brother.
We're going to have a lot more of your calls coming up later this hour, but joining me now is Kaylin Belsha, national reporter for Chalkbeat. Kaylin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Janelle Scott is a professor of education at UC Berkeley. Janelle, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kaylin, let's start with you. There were fears of students falling behind since the beginning of the pandemic. What are some of the biggest gaps in learning that we're seeing so far?
So far, we really just have some data on what happened this spring. We don't really have a good sense of what's happened so far this fall. And we know in the spring, most children were learning virtually. And what most of the reports are showing that have done diagnostic testing, so when children started the school year, those who were able to administer tests to children, these are optional for schools to give. We've seen students falling behind the most in math. And the McKinsey report that you just mentioned, we are seeing there are some instances where students of color lost more gain than white students. And obviously that's concerning because there were already inequities before the pandemic.
Janelle, let's talk a little bit about the rise in failing grades among students of color and students with disabilities. What does that tell us about the learning experiences that these children have been having during the pandemic?
I think it tells us some things, but maybe not enough. I think it shows that educators are likely feeling tremendous pressure to grade in very traditional ways, and we are really schooling in non-traditional times. And so I think, you know, to the extent that grades reflect mastery of subject matter, then we are showing that students are not attaining what teachers and schools would like them to. But I think this also opens up really a conversation to really rethink grading, given that we are in an ongoing pandemic.
Well, let's talk about that, Janelle. You said teachers are under pressure to grade in a certain way. What kind of pressure, and how do you suggest they rethink that?
I think the pressure comes from multiple sources. I think, you know, like the gentleman whose concerns you just aired, there are parents want information about how their children are doing and where the gaps are. I think policymakers increasingly want evidence that schools are serving all children, and researchers also want data, right, in order to provide measurement and make some conclusions about the quality of schooling in remote and hybridized formats. And so I think the pressures are coming from multiple points. And so I do think that particularly in high school, I think what we could do is really rethink letter grades and move to a pass-fail system. I think providing teacher supports to give more narrative assessments of where children are and the kind of specific areas that parents and caregivers might attend to in terms of additional learning supports are some of the ways that we could rethink grading to be a bit more humane and reflecting some of the limitations and severe challenges that families are experiencing right now.
Kaylin, let's talk a little bit about the experiences that many of these children, Black and Brown students, Black and Latino students specifically, disabled students, what learning environments are they learning in that could be contributing to this decline?
Sure. So we know that, of course, in households where there are multiple students learning at the same time, we've heard lots of reports of kids having trouble with the internet because multiple people are trying to stream live video at the same time. This semester, a lot more teachers were trying live instruction to keep students engaged, and that uses a lot of bandwidth. We know students are kind of on different schedules, and so I've heard lots of parents say that they're kind of toggling between many children at the same time. They may not have their own setup. They might be in the same room, and so they're getting distracted by each other. I talked with one mom the other day who said that she put each of her children and tried to put them in different rooms, and then it made it hard for her to oversee their work, and they all had special education plans, so she was trying to make sure that the virtual aids were helping them. So it's just a really challenging environment for lots of parents and lots of kids right now.
Janelle, here in New York, elementary schools are the ones that have reopened. They've closed and then they've reopened depending on the pandemic. But is it students in that age group, younger students, that are more likely to experience these setbacks during the pandemic rather than older students, perhaps middle school and high school students?
I think the sense is that this is really hard for all students at all levels, and it just sort of manifests in different ways, right? And so I think in a very fluid situation in which data and information is coming piecemeal, the sense is that it is less risky to bring younger children back to school, and which is part of the decision New York City made to bring the lower grades back in terms of COVID risk and the benefits that these children would get to be together with their teachers and their peers. But high school students are experiencing, and middle school students are also experiencing, incredible difficulty in remote learning environments, difficulty concentrating, difficulty with boredom and restlessness and nervousness and anxiety. And so I think, you know, all of our children, all of our students really do need supports in terms of their learning, whether it's in person or remotely for the lifetime of this pandemic.
And Janelle, we're also seeing college application rates at least appear to be down this year, particularly for Latino students and low-income students. And that's according to a report from the Washington Post. What does that indicate?
I think we won't know definitively what it indicates until we can get a bit more information. But I think in part it could indicate some concern about starting college in remote fashion and whether there's sort of a return on investment. But also I think there's, you know, we have over 20 million people claiming unemployment benefits right now, according to the Department of Labor. We have the eviction ban issued by the CDC expands on December 31st. And so families are experiencing incredible economic precarity right now that I think we have not maybe paid enough attention to in relation to our conversations about schooling, whether it's K-12 or higher education. And so I worry and wonder that a part of the dip is because of the economic concerns that families are experiencing.
Kaylin, how much of this is really a result of remote versus in-person learning differences? Are there differences in how students of color, Black and Latino students in particular, low-income students, are doing if they're in-person versus remote?
We have seen some surveys about how parents feel about the education that their children are getting. And we know right now it's still true that Black and Latino students are much more likely to be learning online. And so when they've surveyed parents, we've heard, you know, concerns that they think virtual learning could be better, but they're relatively satisfied with it, and they want school districts to spend a lot more time and money investing in improving the remote experience so that they can continue to help their kids learn virtually.
Is that, Kayleen, do we know if that's because parents are concerned about the health and safety issues, or are they saying that remote learning is better generally than in-person learning?
I think it's the first. So I think we're still seeing a lot of concerns about health and safety due to COVID, and the folks who are sending their children in person on surveys, we are seeing much higher positivity rates about they think that in-person learning is better for kids. And I think that is definitely true for parents of color as well.
Janelle, what do you think about whether or not the concerns of low-income parents are being heard? We know that generally when it comes to education and disparities, more affluent parents tend to get their voices heard by school districts, by school boards, by politicians. What about low-income parents and parents of color specifically?
I think we're seeing, as you noted, some divisiveness in with school reopening, with many parents of color indicating that they prefer to stay remote out of concern that the safety measures that need to be in place in terms of COVID risk will not be in place for their children in the schools where they often attend. You know, our schools are terribly segregated by race and socioeconomic status and also language, right? And so parents, I think, have some legitimate and well-earned cynicism about whether the schools that their children attend will be equipped with appropriate PPE, whether mask mandates will be enforced, and whether the ventilation and infrastructure is there for their children to attend school safely. So I think there is some legitimate and well-earned concern and suspicion from parents of color, given their history with schools. And I'm not sure the degree to which policymakers and school leaders are taking those concerns seriously and addressing them. And so I think that's part of the reason, as Kaylin has indicated, parents are saying, please invest in improving the remote experience. And we can do that with ensuring that families have devices and access to high-speed internet and the like, until we can get these other things in place in a physical in-person school situation, which I think parents of all races and socioeconomic brackets would much prefer over remote options.
Kaylin, we've got about a minute left in this part of the conversation, but I'm just curious, schools are already strapped, teachers are already strapped for cash. Are many teachers that you're speaking to having to purchase their own PPE, for example, or their own other types of equipment if they're doing in-person learning?
I've heard less about purchasing their own PPE and more about buying things that might make remote instruction or in-person teaching work better. And we're seeing the kind of donation services online see a huge spike in requests for education donations, so like Donors Choose and things like that. So that indicates, I think, that teachers do need things and are asking for help.
Janelle, we have an incoming presidential administration here and potentially a new Department of Education under Joe Biden. What are some federal policies that you're hoping to see that will help students and teachers, particularly those underfunded during the pandemic?
So we do have a new administration and a, as yet to be named, new Secretary of Education. I think one of the things that would be helpful is really just an infusion of federal supports for schools to be able to provide PPE and implement the infrastructural improvements that are needed to do school in person safely. And so the CARES Act, you know, for example, allocated about $13 billion to public schools in this country, but about half of that money, it's estimated, went to charter schools and to some private schools. And so really thinking about where the majority of children attend school, school-age children attend school, and really investing at the federal level. I think there's a lot the federal government can also do, given the pandemic has ongoing and long-term health and well-being implications. And so providing supports for school psychologists and social workers and mental health supports in schools and communities on an ongoing basis would be a really wonderful federal investment. And then similarly, providing greater investments for childcare and early childhood education. I think those are some things the federal government could do right away that would make a big impact in schools and communities.
Kaylin, we started the conversation talking about the New York City public school system, and it's the largest school district in the country. And it is reopening again this week for in-person learning. This district has opened, it's closed, it's opened up again, it's closed, it's opened up again because of the infection rates. And we understand this is a public health crisis. But there are districts across the country that have stayed remote during this entire time. How have they fared comparatively, or how have the students in those districts fared comparatively to those who, like here in New York, are sort of going back and forth from remote to in-person? Has that had an effect on the performance of students?
So in parent surveys, we have seen that parents are generally about as satisfied with the hybrid teaching, kind of going back and forth between virtual and in-person, as they are with remote. And so there may not be that much benefit when it comes to hybrid teaching, especially when it's kind of interrupted, like you said, going back and forth. I think how students are faring remotely kind of just depends on how much training were their teachers able to attain over the summer. A lot of places were just starting to do live instruction this fall for the very first time. And so how much work teachers were able to do to prepare. We know over the summer, a lot of folks were hoping to open in person. And so they did not get the training and the help that they needed. And so they kind of started behind. Teachers who are juggling kind of the simultaneous teaching where they might have virtual students and also students who are in person, those teachers have expressed very high levels of stress and said they know that their instruction is not as high quality as it could be, and that they're often shortchanging their virtual students who are at home. So if you're a child at home with a teacher in person, you may not be getting the experience that you deserve.
Janelle, we're talking a little bit about the effect that this is having, not just on students' overall performance, but also on their mental health. Is that a critical part of making sure that students survive this really challenging year? And if so, how do you implement something like that in a virtual landscape?
Well, I think, number one, I think we need to acknowledge that we are in a crisis, right? And so we keep, I think, we feel this pull toward providing what looks like normal school for children when these aren't normal times. And this is a unique crisis in that its end is not totally clear and predictable. And so I think it requires, as we've been talking about, not only additional preparation for teachers, but really a rethinking of what a robust schooling and learning looks like during a crisis. And so I think there's a call and a need for approach to deeper learning, more project-based learning, and a focus on relationships and connection to keep children curious and engaged in their own learning for when normal times emerge. But we're not there yet. And I think children and teachers are feeling the brunt of that, of being asked to act as if things are normal and learn as if things are normal when they are not.
Kaylin, before we go, are there any broader education overhauls that we could expect the Biden administration to implement when they take office in the next couple of weeks?
So President-elect Biden has said that he supports the kind of compromise stimulus legislation that's been floated, but that only contains $82 billion for schools. And he has said that he wants a lot more than that kind of overall spending. So I think the big question is, are they able to get more money, and can they spend some of that for addressing learning loss? That's something that the president-elect has said he really wants to do. So can we implement widespread tutoring and more summer school and much more intensive supports for students, which we know are probably going to be what students need? So that's a really big, just kind of open-ended question. We're not really sure how the country is going to try to address all that.
There's a lot to think about as we head into this new administration. Janelle Scott is a professor of education at UC Berkeley. And Kaylin Belsha is a national reporter for Chalkbeat. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
We asked you, parents and caregivers, what you're seeing and how you might try to address these delays in the kids in your life. And here's what some of you had to say.
My name is Evan from Rockton, Illinois. My six-year-old daughter is struggling reading and math. She is below where she needs to be, and I believe she may need to repeat first grade if she doesn't get some extreme intervention this summer. I plan to get her in with a tutor service to help catch up, but even with that, I know there are emotional and social struggles she has as well. She has no friends to hang out with her age, and most of her time has been spent with her parents, grandparents, and little brother.
Hi, this is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Our kids have been touch and go with remote learning. They're both pretty social, and they're social learners, so independent work while both parents are working is pretty difficult, honestly. We're all managing pretty well together, and we're taking it one day at a time, but we're also trying not to stress out about objectives, just about keeping their minds active.
This is Josie from Uxbridge. While my child's only 4, this was supposed to be his first year in school. I don't have other children or friends with children, so I was excited for him to finally get some practice with his social skills. My husband and I talk a lot about our concerns regarding his social development. I fear that he's behind, and this may have long-term effects on how he functions in society. My initial thought was to try and find other moms online that were COVID conscious and could be part of our bubble. But there's nowhere to meet, and the weather's getting colder. It's been really difficult. I guess we'll try school again next year, hopefully.
Hi, this is Terry from Tabernash, Colorado. My grandson is very intelligent. He's bilingual in English and Russian, and he's always done a great job of teaching himself things that interest him, like making sushi and forging steel. He is failing at online school and remote learning. I'm concerned about him, but trust he will be able to catch up when we get back to normal. Both his parents are well-educated and have good jobs, and we'll see that he gets tutoring or whatever help he needs. What really concerns me, though, is the many kids in struggling situations who don't have his advantages and might fall through the cracks and never be able to catch up.
Hi, my name is Kim. I'm in Brick, New Jersey. I was hired in August as a babysitter slash nanny for 2 siblings, a male, 5 years old, and a girl, 7. My main responsibility is to help them to navigate independent learning. The teachers are amazing. I am impressed every day at how they interact with the children and have expanded their own knowledge and use of technology. The second grader can work pretty independently. The 5-year-old, on the other hand, needs constant and consistent redirecting. He's easily distracted by the dog, toys that are in his sight line when he perceives that his sister is not working, having to stare at a screen for hours on end. If we lived in a society where it wasn't so impossible to live without 2 incomes in a household, I could seriously see virtual learning becoming a part of our everyday life.
My name is Kat from Polk County, Florida. I'm a testing coordinator for a high poverty high school in rural central Florida. A large number of our students have disengaged from the learning process. The school year began with 2/3 of our student population in e-learning. Now a little over half remain in distance learning. That being said, loss of an academic year, although tragic, can be recovered. Loss of life due to COVID has no chance of regaining what is lost.
So many of you told us that your primary concern is the emotional and developmental delays this time might cause for your kids. So we're going to dive into that in a future segment. So if that's a concern for you, tell us what support you're getting or how you might address it at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. It's The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
In the past few years, Puerto Rico has experienced crisis after crisis, and earlier this year, in an attempt to further address the island's debt crisis, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority began making moves to privatize the island's electric grid. For years, the government-owned Electric Power Authority has faced difficulties, including debt and mismanagement and damage from Hurricane Maria in 2017. But the move to privatize the electric grid fits into a larger pattern of privatization and austerity measures on the island. Since 2016, when the Puerto Rican Financial Oversight Board was established to address the island's multi-billion-dollar debt, the board has attempted to privatize other industries on the island. Ed Morales has been following all of this. He's a freelance journalist based in New York and author of Fantasy Island: Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. Ed, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So remind us, the Public Power Authority has faced challenges over the past few years, including what?
Well, I mean, the main challenge is the $9 billion debt, which is one of the largest segments of the debt. You know, Puerto Rico's debt, which is $72 billion, is broken up into a lot of different entities. Before that, you know, the main problems for the Power Authority is the fact that it's an antiquated system. Hardly any of the lines are underground. It's all overground, so very vulnerable, famously, to the Hurricane Maria, which knocked down all these poles, as you know. So one of the things that they tried to do to manage the fact that they were in debt is laying off a lot of workers, which then made the keeping up of the poles even worse. You know, you could drive around the mountains and see all this outgrowth of vegetation, and they were swallowing up the poles. The privatization of the electrical authority has been in the works for some time, and it's just intensified under the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board that was imposed in 2017.
Let's talk about that management board. That's, you're talking about PROMESA. Remind us how that fiscal oversight board came together and who was on it.
Well, in 2016, the governor of Puerto Rico declared that the debt was unpayable after years of irresponsible borrowing that was aided by Wall Street firms and speculators. The Obama administration was worried about seeming that they wanted to give Puerto Rico a bailout. So rather than renegotiate the terms of the debt directly, what they did was they set up this Fiscal Oversight and Management Board through a bill that was passed in Congress in 2016 called PROMESA. That bill provided for the appointment of 7 members of the board, and half of the members would be picked by Democratic members of Congress and the other half Republican. And then the 7th would be picked by Obama. All of the members of the board are from the financial sector, which I guess is obvious, but it's an indication that, you know, dealing with everyday people's problems is not at their forefront. Their forefront is to restructure the debt. So the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board is basically a representative of the business community that is making decisions about Puerto Rico's budget. Because all of the budgets that the government produces has to be approved by the Fiscal Oversight and Management Board.
I mean, the question I have is, we know that Puerto Rico was in a significant amount of debt. We have to remind people that before Hurricane Maria, that was one of the biggest issues pressing on the island. This board was set up to try to attempt to manage that. And now the board seems to have favored privatization of different organizations and utilities on the island. Is the only organization we're talking about being privatized the utility, or are there other attempts at privatization on Puerto Rico?
Yeah, I mean, there has been a brief history of privatization in Puerto Rico, beginning earlier in the 2010s with the privatization of the airport, for instance. It was sold to a Mexican company. The toll roads and the maintenance of the highways was sold to a Spanish company. And then there was a sort of a botched privatization of the sewer and aqueduct authority, which had to be abandoned because it was causing higher prices for water.
Who and how would the privatization of the electric utility affect most?
Well, I mean, that's an easy question. It's basically the consumers, because there have been studies done that the price of electricity, which is already among the highest of anyone within the U.S. and its territories, would increase significantly. And Puerto Rico average income is far below the poorest state in the union. So they're already paying too much for electricity, and a rate increase, which not only has been predicted by studies, but has been floated in the media, would affect an already reeling population. And still trying to recover from the hurricane and other things like the homelessness created by the earthquakes earlier this year.
Are there any other privatization efforts promoted by this Fiscal Oversight Board right now?
Well, one of the things that's on the horizon is privatizing some of the lands that the university owns. And part of that process would entail raising tuition rates further. There has been a process of trying to privatize the public school system by introducing more charter schools, but that's going to hit a major snag because with new President Biden, Betsy DeVos, who was involved with the former Secretary of Education, Julia Kelleher, in the privatization of the school system, won't be there anymore. And Julie Kelleher herself has been indicted on fraud charges, and her trial will be coming up next year. Still, you know, the school system is in disarray, but I mean, sadly, it's not going to be moving forward much. The only plan for moving forward was privatization, and that's really hit a snag.
U.S. Representative Raul Grijalva from Arizona has put forth legislation to reform the PROMESA board. What are some of those proposals, and is it enough?
Well, Grijalva, I think it's a really well-intentioned thing that he tried to do. He wants to have federal funding for the board, which costs several hundred million dollars that the Puerto Rico people pay for themselves just to pay for the members of the board and all its activities and the courts. They also improve the access to information because a lot of the information surrounding the board, even though they publish a lot of things on the website, has been obscured to the people. Some more relief from the debt, a comprehensive audit of the debt, which is something that should have happened before the imposition of PROMESA and was really undermined by both the Puerto Rico government and the process of creating PROMESA law itself. And the thing is, why it's not enough is most people on the island really believe that the only way for real economic growth to happen on the island is for canceling a really substantial amount of the debt. Columbia University economists put out a report several years ago that said that up to 90% of the debt should be canceled because even with the restructuring, for instance, there was a deal reached about the sales tax, which is called COFINA, which is the highest of any state or territory in the United States at 11.25%.
Let's just be clear, Ed, that if you purchase something in Puerto Rico, your sales tax is 11.25%.
Yeah, and it's quite a sticker shock. So that part of the financing of the government and the debt has been restructured. And that deal has been criticized as, you know, giving way too much money that should be going to essential services in Puerto Rico to the holders of the debt, you know, who are mostly large investment firms and, you know, what they call vulture funds.
Ed, it feels, I'm wondering about the privatization, not just of the utility on the island, but also the land. You mentioned some of the land from the University of Puerto Rico being talked about making that land private. But what about things like beaches and beachfront that in some parts of the island has been untouched and is just pristine? I'm thinking about the island of Culebra, for example, and other parts of the island. Are those also at risk for privatization?
Yeah, because the real estate industry is always looking for opportunity. And, you know, right now, because prices of real estate fell substantially after the hurricane and in some measures after the earthquakes, investment is really being encouraged. And there's development of luxury housing that's booming in Puerto Rico. There are a couple of projects on the north coast of Puerto Rico. There's a resort there that's being developed by John Paulson, who is a notorious character from Wall Street that was involved in the 2008 crisis, who, you know, it's that stuff about building property too close to the land, and then it causes beach erosion. That's happened in Condado, too. There's been a lot of real estate development in Vieques. Culebra is probably next. It's less developed. But, you know, unfortunately, this is something that plagues the United States, overdeveloping near the coastline and causing damage to the land.
And finally, you mentioned canceling the debt, Ed. I'm wondering, with the new Biden administration coming in, are we going to see a similar approach from Joe Biden and his administration, having, you know, been Obama's vice president? Or will a Biden administration be open to finally canceling the debt in Puerto Rico and starting fresh?
Well, you know, that would be nice, and it would really aid the future development of Puerto Rico in a serious way, show a serious commitment to the economic development of Puerto Rico. You know, I kind of like to look at that the way that there's been debate about the canceling of student debt. You know, at first, there's a lot of proposals about canceling in its entirety. Now there are proposals about $50,000 for each person. So I think there's going to be a negotiation. I hope that there is a really substantial canceling of Puerto Rico debt, particularly because it seems that the Biden administration is going to try to reverse as many things as possible that happened under Trump administration. And the handling of Puerto Rico is a fairly major thing, particularly when you keep in mind the embarrassing siphoning away of votes to Republicans in Florida. And so making a serious commitment to Puerto Rico would really shore up the Democrats' numbers in Florida.
Turning the subject for a minute, Ed, I'm a New Yorkerican. I have mixed feelings about using that word, but in this context, we can absolutely use it. There's a cafe downtown Manhattan called the New Yorkerican Poets Cafe, and one of its founders, Miguel Algarin, passed away recently. And I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about his legacy. I myself went to the New Yorkerican Poets Cafe as a young woman growing up in that community, being Puerto Rican, being from New York, and spent many nights there watching poetry slams. It was transformative to my development as a thinker, as a writer, and just feeling like there was a place for us. What were your thoughts on the passing of Miguel Algarin?
I always grew up wanting to write. I wrote a lot of poetry and creative writing when I was younger. And so when I first saw the poetry that came out of New Yorkerican Poets Cafe, it was really freeing to me because what they did was they mixed English and Spanglish, and it seemed like an intense source of creativity. Opening up of language and being able to express a hybrid identity, you know, that New Yorkerans have, combining the both of the best of being an island Puerto Rican and being a New Yorker. So, you know, Miguel was really, he was one of the founders, but the other founders, you know, passed away, back in the 70s and 80s. So he was a real survivor and one of the real driving forces. It was his living room where the first salons were held that were eventually moved into the physical building on 6th Street, the first location. And not only that, you know, he was so varied in his influences. You know, he was a really strong Africanist. He was really involved in African-American literature. Harlem Renaissance took a lot of inspiration for that. And he had a really fluid sexual identity, which he also, pioneered a lot of queer writing for Puerto Ricans or Latinos in the U.S., even though that's not one of the main things that people talk about him when they do. And then he was an incredible survivor because he was diagnosed with HIV in the late 1980s and continued to play a major role in the cafe up until just about 5 years ago.
Ed Morales is a freelance journalist based in New York and author of Fantasy Island, Colonialism, Exploitation, and the Betrayal of Puerto Rico. Ed, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So far in 2020, we've seen television reboots of shows like Party of Five, The Babysitter's Club, and now Saved by the Bell. When I wake up in the morning, the alarm gives out a warning. I don't think I'll ever make it on time. Available on NBC's streaming service Peacock, the series follows a diverse new crop of students at Bayside High, with cameos from characters from the original series like A.C. Slater, Jesse Spano, and of course, Zach Morris. The reboot, however, shakes up the privileged bubble of Bayside High, tackling issues of race, class, sexuality, and education inequity head on.
Dog, I'm telling you, man, this school is wild. Like, they got beach volleyball in a different club called Beach Volleyball Resort Sand. No cap, there's more people signed up for the Artisanal Bath Bomb Club than football.
Saved by the Bell is just the latest reboot to both capitalize on nostalgia while also tackling issues important to a new generation of viewers. Here to discuss more is Jen Chaney, TV critic at Vulture. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
So I have a question for you, Jen. Why so many reboots? Like, why don't we just start new shows? Well, what is the point of all this?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. One is, you know, we're a nostalgic culture. And we love to go back in time and kind of gain comfort from those old shows. But also, you know, you're seeing all these streaming networks that are coming up. And I think, for example, Peacock, which is obviously affiliated with NBC, they're always looking at what's in our catalogs already and how can we leverage those in a way to bring more viewers in and have them engage with that catalog. So, you know, if somebody comes to Peacock to watch the new Saved by the Bell, well, then maybe they'll hang around to watch episodes of the old Saved by the Bell or Saved by the Bell the college years or, you know, other things that they already have in their libraries. And so I think there's a audience attraction kind of financial reason for doing this as well.
So I was going to ask you about the financial element of this here, because, I mean, is it really worth bringing back a show that a whole generation of folks might not have paid attention to the first time it was around, or really just a question of resources in terms of creating a new show, getting a new writer's room, things like that?
Right. I mean, I think, and this is true in the movies as well as TV, I think there's a thought process that something that's already somewhat familiar to at least some of the audience is going to be more successful than something that's completely brand new and we have to do at least some of the work to market it. That may or may not be true, but I think that's where some of the thinking comes from. And I think, you know, Saved by the Bell is a good example of, yes, people who watched it when they were younger might be interested, but it's really about contemporary teens. So I think the idea is it will attract potentially younger viewers as well. And you kind of get that sweet spot where both, say, the parents and the kids are interested in something.
A lot of these reboots, Jen, also seem to take the original premise of a show, and we saw this with Party of Five and Murphy Brown, for example, and now Saved by the Bell, in which they don't just reboot the show, they basically take the characters and make them more diverse. They try to address issues that are happening today. Do these storylines get lost after a while if you're taking a whole new set of characters and sort of just making them diverse? Or is that performative or is it real change?
I think it can be both. It really depends on how the creators and people involved in making the series tackle the material. You know, with Saved by the Bell, I think Tracy Wigfield, who is the showrunner, she's worked on 30 Rock. She also created a really funny show called Great News. I think she did something really smart, which is, you know, people have affection for the original Saved by the Bell, but they also realize that it was kind of ridiculous. And she took what was ridiculous about it, which is, for one thing, Zach Morris, who was the hero, quote unquote, of the show, was constantly doing, you know, terrible things to people and playing pranks on people. And yet we were supposed to be rooting for him every time he got away with it. And she recognized that as being sort of a bubble in terms of being removed from reality. And then she braided into that what you alluded to before, which is the fact that kids from another high school end up coming to Bayside that don't have all the advantages of maybe the Bayside kids. And she weaves into that this whole issue of social inequity in our public school system, which, you know, in this year with the pandemic, all of that stuff has come into even starker relief. So I think that has made Saved by the Bell more relevant even than when Tracy Wigfield came up with the idea originally.
We're seeing reboots of shows from the late 80s and early 90s. We're also seeing reunion specials like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air on HBO Max. What is it about this time period, for those of us, including myself, who lived it the first time, looking around and saying, what is it about this time period that's so interesting to and appealing to people who want to reboot shows?
Well, I think part of it is that the people who want to reboot shows are people like you and I who grew up in that time period, and maybe we're kind of a little fixated on it. And some of it is the people who are also giving the green light. You know, the executives also maybe grew up in the 80s or 90s and kind of have an affection for it and immediately recognize, okay, I remember this, so therefore everybody else is going to love it also. But I also think, you know, you look at the success of other shows that have been brand new but have been period shows, and I'm thinking specifically of Stranger Things, which is set in the 80s. And I think that's a great example of a show that hit really big because the parents really liked it because it felt so retro. But, you know, kids like my son, who are preteen, teenager, they got really into it on their own terms as well. And I think everybody that's rebooting something is trying to achieve what Stranger Things did.
the thing about Stranger Things is that it was a new production. It wasn't sort of a reboot. Do you see a lot more reboots happening in the future, or are we sort of exhausting this? Because we've been, I'd say for the past 2 years, we've been, or not you and I, but the industry, if you will, has really been focused on things like One Day at a Time and these other really hardcore period pieces that feel stuck, if you will. Are we at the end of the reboot hurrah?
I don't think so, not yet. I mean, there are still some that are in the works and coming into being. They're talking about rebooting Good Times, for example, but as an animated series for Netflix. There is a reboot of The Wonder Years, actually, that is in the works, which is a show that I really loved. And that, to me, is interesting because they're trying to do it from the perspective of a Black person growing up who would have a very different view of what was going on in the 1960s. So no, the reboots are not going away at all, not anytime soon.
Jen, do the people who originally, how does the money work for a reboot? Do the people who originally created the show still benefit financially if the show is rebooted?
Well, certainly they do if they're involved. And I think in a lot of these cases, we do see involvement. Like Norman Lear was one of the producers on the reboot of One Day at a Time. He's involved in this reboot of Good Times. The Wonder Years one that I mentioned, Neil Marlins, who was one of the co-creators of the original series, he's involved. So is Fred Savage. So certainly if they're involved in some way, they benefit. But I think in a sort of broader sense, even if they're not still involved, they benefit from people being, you know, just aware of their previous work again and maybe revisiting again is the biggest benefit that they draw from it.
Jen Chaney is a TV critic at Vulture. Jen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
You got to reboot Quantum Leap, but this time with a female lead, maybe like the child of the original main character, Sam Beckett. More emphasis on a consciousness and spirituality that was inherent in the original, but you can explore that more deeply. Netflix, call me. I'll make it.
Hi, my name is Lee Jones. I'm calling from Philadelphia. A childhood favorite of mine was Thundercats, and I would love to see a live-action version, but with a mixed-race cast, because what I always loved about Thundercats is that they looked like me.
Hi, this is your friend Ellen from Pittsburgh. You know, I loved 30-something. That would be cool to see for this generation, especially as someone now outside of it, looking at what they might like.
Greatest American Hero, the 1980 or 1981 show from ABC that starred William Catt. The reboot would have Tiffany Haddish finding the superpowered suit. My name is Thomas Shea. I'm from Studio City, California.
This is Donna McGreevy calling from Columbia, South Carolina. One of my all-time favorite shows, Monk. I would love to see how Mr. Monk would do with COVID and all the safety precautions that everyone else is taking now. I think it would be interesting to see his take on it.
Hi, this is Elizabeth from Arkansas. I would love to see Logan's Run remade, tied in with climate change today. And I think it would be kind of funny to see how the millennials of today take to being called old in the TV show.
Frasier would be the show I would love to see rebooted. Oh my God. Oh, change the location to a red state. Niles and Frasier's heads would completely blow up.
All right, that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.